L'existence, je suppose, souvent n'est qu'une chanson.
In the wee hours of the morning, in the coffee-fueled bistros of the night, we find a spot to sit down and, oh my, these folks are having a very serious conversation.
Immorality is subjective.
Yes, but subjectivity is objective.
To avoid suffering, one must not love.
Human beings are divided into mind and body.
But then one suffers from not loving.
Perception is irrational and implies imminence.
Therefore, to love is to suffer, not to love is to suffer.
After all, you know, there are worse things in life than death.
Sounds like a convention of existentialists.
See, surface, and think that in some sense it's depth, and it isn't.
But of course, it's just a dream of a late-night argument between Jean-Paul Sartre, Simone de Beauvoir, Albert Camus, or Michel Foucault. We assembled it from bits of Woody Allen, Diane Keaton, and Camille Paglia. In the silly season of the 2016 campaign, articulate, actual, serious, smart folks just might be welcome. And that we all might stumble on such real conversations is the dream of author Sarah Bakewell's new book, At the Existentialist Cafe, Freedom, Being, and Apricot Cocktails. The book is a clever and surprisingly entertaining romp through the existentialist movement of the early part of the 20th century, in which Bakewell deftly argues that we really need to be talking just as seriously about issues like the meaning of freedom, existence, and gender in the 21st century.
I visualize it as, you know, there's very familiar figures there. There's Jean-Paul Sartre,
of course,
with his pipe,
yep,
and his sort of, you know, somewhat dumpy shape. And then next to him, there's Simone de Beauvoir,
of course,
rather more elegant, also smoking her head off. Albert Camus, another sort of well-known figure with his collar turned up and looking quite Humphrey Bogart-ish and glamorous. Then there's the sort of lesser-known figures and people coming and going. Some people play a role in the story for a little while. So these are kind of encounters that could lead to books. They could lead to interesting conversations. They could lead to fights because their conversation would be of politics, literature, philosophy, and often they'd get so passionately involved in it all that they'd end up falling out.
You take us to a place in time and then try to catapult us into now and to how that outlook might help us. What writers can you imagine that gang hanging out with today? And maybe not even writers, maybe just sort of public figures.
Well, I think that one of the things particularly about Sartre and Simone de Beauvoir and Camus was, you know, they also saw themselves as being passionately involved in the debates of the day. So I think they would certainly be airing their views on everything from politics to the sort of cultural debates that we have today.
One of the things that's kind of amazing to me is that the existentialists were seen as a fairly brooding bunch, but there's a lot of levity to the way in which they approach philosophy and ideas compared to now. You know, the existentialists seem much more relevant.
But they certainly saw themselves as being relevant, and they also, especially talking about that period in Paris at the end of the Second World War, after the liberation of Paris and when everything seemed to start afresh and everybody was kind of still just getting over the war. But on the other hand, there was this great sense of possibility because all of the old ways or many of the old ways of doing things had been thrown into question. So, you know, getting your values from the state or from the church or from the family, suddenly there was this new sense that you could actually maybe change the human condition and do things in a completely new way. And that's what led to the sort of the image that we have of the existentialists as sort of dancing all night and hanging out in these jazz bars and sort of rebelling and making up their own rules as they went along, sort of rejecting the old bourgeois model as they saw it. It's interesting that Richard Wright, he explicitly wanted to write an existentialist novel about the African-American experience, and that's what The Outsider became. When he first encountered existentialism, he wrote to Gertrude Stein, who was a friend, saying, I can't understand why everybody seems to think existentialism is such a gloomy philosophy. For me, it means freedom and, you know, liberation and optimism, really.
Did the permission that existentialism gave to contemplate in a purely abstract way what being is all about allow Simone de Beauvoir to invent a Western feminism?
Well, she came out of philosophical studies, which had included phenomenology, which was this sort of German methodology that you can start philosophy essentially by describing experience, so describing what things are actually like as you encounter them, rather than having to piece it all together from abstract theories. There's this sort of story about the apricot cocktail that was their first encounter with this, which is where a friend of theirs said to them, they were sitting around drinking apricot cocktails one day, and he said, "You see, if you're a phenomenologist, you can talk about this cocktail and make philosophy out of it," which became the sort of the great spark that sent them off. It's a way of cutting through some of the philosophical problems about how we can be certain of anything. So you still can't be sure that I'm really here,
right?
But you can act as though you were sure that I was really here,
because I'm doing that's, a good
that
job
makes
of that.
A good yes, starting point for a conversation.
Well, I think young people are attracted to this experimental way of thinking, this breaking of the rules, the different narratives of sexuality. How would you say existentialism applies to the, it seems like there's no conceivable rules in sexuality and gender roles today?
I mean, I think that it doesn't totally look that straightforward. I mean, some fields of life, yes, the enormous battles have been won as far as sexual freedom is concerned. And in other departments, the whole question of freedom is looming up in a much more problematic way again, I think. I mean, there's all sorts of debates about freedom as a sort of civic concept, whether freedom includes the freedom to act in a way that offends others or to speak in the way that offends others. I think there's a lot to talk about. And really, freedom was the central existentialist theme, at least it certainly was for Sartre and Simone de Beauvoir. And we're no closer to finding any kind of solution, not that there would ever be one. I mean, the whole point of freedom is that we continue to be free to decide how we're going to live our freedom and what we're going to consider that freedom consists of. There's never going to be a kind of a law about how you can and can't use your freedom.
So let's say we're in a cafe in Paris today and we're encountering these characters. First of all, would they have iPhones?
Yeah, that's one of the first things that comes to mind with me when I picture this existentialist cafe, is the awful thought that today, instead of conversing, wildly arguing or flirting or whatever they were doing at the time, that they'd all be sitting around staring at their phones. It's a very sad thought. Although, in another way, you could say, well, maybe they're all having very engaging conversations via text messages and Twitter with other people. You know, I mean, they're still conversing, just not with each other.
Sarah Bakewell is the author of At the Existentialist Cafe, Freedom, Being, and Apricot Cocktails. Thanks so much.
Thanks very much.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.